Okay. First, let me begin by saying this is a real thrill. I've never done anything like this. I don't know if anyone has. And the credit really has to go both to Rabbi Kelman, who you see, although you saw her a second ago. Well, there he is. And Shalom in the upper right, who's the technical wizard. Rabbi Kelman really, in many ways, is thinking ahead of his time. As if some of you are on here because of an ad you saw or something on a listserv, I recommend going to the Torah in Motion website. You'll see things that don't take place anywhere else in the country, indeed the world, in terms of advanced education, Jewish education. So it's a real thrill to be here. Let me also say that I will speak. I'll pause for questions, but if you have a question, just send me a little note at the bottom. I can see them. I hear them when they come through with, as question, and I'll stop, and you can speak. Or if you prefer to write the question, you can do that as well. Understand that everyone, though, sees what you write, if that's an issue. Without further ado, then let us begin. It'll go for about an hour or more, whenever the rabbi tells me to stop. This is planned for five classes, called Architects of Modern Orthodoxy, from Samson Raphael Hirsch to Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, and we'll look at Rav Kook in the middle, as well as Is My Want. We'll do a number of other things, as I'm getting used to talking from sitting down. I did give out source pages, not that I will be reading them per se in the lectures, but I think you can get them from Rabbi Kelman. If you might want to look later on what I spoke about, I'll be quoting from some sources, or for next class, I think it will be helpful. Now, before we begin, let me note that there are a number of differences, I believe, between modern and right-wing orthodoxy. The latter today is known as Haredi orthodoxy. What are some of them? Well, first of all, we have Israel, how to view the state of Israel, secular studies, the position of women, non-religious groupings, that is, how do you relate to the Reform and the Conservative movement. I'll tell you, it used to be non-religious Jews. There's a lot of sources that speak about how we're supposed to relate to non-religious Jews and a typical, I guess you would say, ultra-Orthodox position in the 20s and 30s was to view them very negatively. So if someone showed up at the Western Wall, let's say, with shorts and a T-shirt, they would have a chair thrown at them or something. Today they'd be brought in and sent to someone's Shabbos table. The Haredi groups today lead the Kirov movement, but that was not always the case. Halachic development, a big difference between the modern Orthodox and the right-wing Orthodox. Das Torah, the notion that the Gedolim, the sages, really have absolute authority in non-halachic matters. Acceptance of superstition, I guess we would say, demons, astrology, biblical literalism, and others. Now, the figures we're going to be looking at, and if I'm speaking louder, but if I'm too loud for people, you can always turn down your sound. The figures we're going to be looking at do not correspond in every way with modern Orthodox groups today or modern Orthodox thought today. We'll see a few cases where they're actually very opposed to what usually goes for modern Orthodoxy in the year 2006. But we will also see that they created the environment and established the basis for what became known today as modern orthodoxy. Now, before we go further, a word about orthodox, the term. It originated in Germany, and if Hirsch is to be believed, it was invented by the reformers, and it was actually a pejorative term to describe their opponents. Now, the fact that it was adopted by the traditionalists shouldn't surprise us, as throughout history, many groups have taken negative terms and used them themselves. By the way, if those people are not hearing, I'm speaking pretty loud. The problem is probably on your computer. It's a little hard to really deal with this now. Certainly before we sign on a little early next time, I don't believe it's the problem on us. My sound is up all the way, so it's not a problem with me. Shalom, you're hearing me fine? Yeah, so it's... It's people on their own computers that you have to deal with the sound. Most of the time, right on the front of your computer, you'll have a button that you could turn it all the way up. As I mentioned, the term was a negative term, and it was adopted. And I said this is a strategy in history. Queer, for example, reference to gays, and now we have queer nation. Mitnagdim was first a term used by the Hasidim to describe their opponents, the Mitnagdim, And the Mitnagdim took this term and very happily used it, when in fact the Hasidim were actually much more the opponents of the standard way of doing things. The N-word for African-Americans, which they've adopted at least as an intergroup term. Now, Hirsch, however, was one of those who opposed the term Orthodox. Why would someone oppose this term? Well, first of all, it's a Christian term. The term Orthodox does not come from the Jewish lexicon. Nowhere in the Talmud or the Rambam or the Rishonim or Acharonim do you have any observant Jew referred to as Orthodox. So that's automatically one reason why you might not want to use it, Kukos HaGoyim, or however you want to describe it. But there's another reason, a more substantive reason. When you use the term Orthodox, it implies that there's an Orthodox way of Judaism, and then there's another way, a liberal way, a conservative way. And from the perspective of many of the traditionalists, there were simply Jews who were Torah true, Torah observant, and those who are less observant. But not that there was such thing as different interpretations of Judaism. There were simply Jews punctilious in mitzvot and Jews who were not. Many in Germany instead used the term gesetztreu, which means faithful to the law. Torah true is how it's often translated into English, although the term does not really mean that. Although this has problems as well, because orthodoxy has always meant not simply observance of the law, but also it has an ideological component. So it's hard to find a term. We will stick to orthodox. Now, we're going to talk about the origins today. Some of you are wondering, well, why don't we start with the Rambam? After all, the Rambam is always portrayed as having this great openness to secular culture, as opposed to the rabbis in France and Germany who are thought to not be open to these things. So isn't the Rambam the advocate of some sort of modern orthodoxy? I'll tell you, it's ironic. When Rabbi Soloveitchik, I know Torah in Motion is having this incredible conference on him shortly, when he went to Boston and opened up a school, he called it the Maimonides School. When the Reform opened up a school some years later, they certainly would have loved to call their school the Maimonides School, because Maimonides, an openness to secular culture, but the name was already taken, so they called their school the Rashi School. Now, certainly no Reform rabbi ever looked towards Rashi as an idol, but be that as it may, there is a Reform school called the Rashi School. But what about Maimonides? This image of Maimonides as one who joined secular to Jewish has always been central to those Jews who wanted some sort of interaction between the Jewish and the secular. And his embrace of Aristotle was thought to provide a justification for later generations embracing the philosophies of their time. Yet although the Rambam did provide inspiration, although as we'll see, not for Hirsch, but for others, certainly, he differs in a fundamental way from the modern Orthodox thinkers we will see. Because first of all, he had no interest in, quote, secular studies. For the Rambam, for example, there's no need to study history. He has negative things to say about that. The only, quote, secular subjects he's interested in are metaphysics and science, such as astronomy, physics, chemistry. For the Rambam, indeed for all medieval philosophers, there is nothing secular about philosophy. Aristotle is studied because he's the repository of divine truth. The medieval philosophers, the Rambam and others, although it might strike us as anachronistic, they viewed Avraham and Moshe as philosophers. For the Rambam, the philosophy, it was not that we had it and they stole it, but we all had it and we lost it. And that science and philosophy for the Rambam is part of Torah. We have to love God. How do you love God? By knowing God. Therefore, this is part of a divine command. The Torah says, the Bible says that the heavens declare God's glory. So by studying God's creations, we become close to Him. This is very different than the 19th century modern Orthodox, who clearly recognize the existence of secular subjects. These subjects might reflect Torah values. They help us understand Torah, but they are not identical to Torah. Science is important to help us understand Torah, but it's not Torah. One does not achieve the world to come through study of science. So these figures we're going to talk about are significant in that they recognize the value of the secular world, while for the Rambam, anything of value in the secular world is part of Torah. So that's a big difference. Another difference between the modern Orthodox thinkers in the 19th century and the Rambam is that the Rambam was never interested in creating a movement. His philosophy is elitist. And not just, not covertly, overt elitism. Even in the Mishnah Torah, he speaks about certain people, this is okay, others it's not. So there's an elitism for the Rambam. I mean, the path of the intellectual is always opposed to the path of the masses. When it comes to intellectual matters, the philosopher wants to escape and go to his ivory tower and study philosophy and get close to God. Although the Rambam, as a leader of the community, we see the tension in his own life. But modern orthodoxy is a movement, a mass movement, or at least it tries to be. So the Rambam is not the beginning. Some might be thinking, well, what about Spain, the golden age of Spain, 12th century, and earlier, 11th century, where for a significant period, Jews of Spain were very well integrated into Gentile society, in commerce, in government. They were also observant of Torah law. And the golden age of Spain was often cited by modern Orthodox figures as what they're trying to get to, where Jews can be totally observant and yet integrated with secular civilization. Yet, I would say that this enlightened traditionalism, if that's what we want to call it in Spain, was just an episode. No continuity. I have no doubt that modern Orthodoxy in Germany would have developed the exact same way had there never been a golden age of Spain. Now, there's a more fundamental difference, though, between Neo-Orthodoxy, as it was called, what we're calling modern Orthodoxy, and its precursors in the 17th century, 16th century. And that relates to how contemporary scholars, in particular Jacob Katz, used the term traditional society and Orthodox society, with medieval Spain being a traditional society and 19th century Germany being an Orthodox society. So what is a traditional society? A traditional society is a society in which there are no other religious options available short of conversion. Everyone develops in that society, and although, to be sure, there's sinners, there's always sinners, even the sinners expect to go to synagogue on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and repent, everyone accepts, in a traditional society, the basic religious structures. Not everyone lives up to these structures, the demands, but how people act in a traditional society is a matter of tradition. Everyone just expects this. This is what Jews do. You grew up with this. The term used by Chaim Soloveitchik is mimetic, a mimetic society, from the word imitate, mimic, mimesis. Jews generally, why do you put on tefillin in the morning? Because that's what Jews do, and Christians do that. Thought is not given to it. Orthodox societies, on the other hand, are the product of modern times, where beginning in the 19th century, even before, but then certainly today, everyone recognizes that they, who's Orthodox, who's observant, that they're in the minority, and it's a conscious choice. You choose to be observant, and in doing so, you recognize that you are doing something different than the rest of society. That's very different than when you grow up in a society where that's what everyone does, and no thought is given to it. Beginning with you can say we have an Orthodoxy when, in order to be observant, you must actually think about it, give thought to it. Sephardic societies, for the most part, were traditional societies for a lot longer than Ashkenazic societies. Now, in an Orthodox society as well, because people are self-conscious, the leadership has to adopt all sorts of measures to prevent their co-religionists from abandoning the tradition, because there's another option available just down the street. So to point to the beginning of modern Orthodoxy, we must look at Germany in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. And after looking at some of its characteristics, I think we will have a good idea as to how much of so-called modern Orthodoxy today has departed from its origins, what was known then as the Neo-Orthodoxy, although the term has fallen out of favor. Okay, so now that we agree it's in Germany, where do we start? Some of you might be thinking Moses Mendelssohn, after all. Although he was condemned after his death as an apostate due to what became of his children, some people might want to look at him, because look how he lived. He was a completely observant Torah Jew, and yet he was involved in Salon society. He was a great philosopher. In fact, he stood one rung under Kant. So here you have someone participating to the fullest in non-Jewish life, as well as being a great philosopher. And if you're going to say, look at his children, that's really irrelevant. I can point to you children of great Hasidic rabbis who became totally non-religious, even apostates, for heaven's sakes. A new book that just came out about the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. His son became a convert to Christianity at the same time that Mendelssohn's children were converting. So certainly what becomes of one's children is not a good measure in judging someone. At the same time Mendelssohn was doing what he was doing, the Baal Shem Tov was founding Chassidut. And German Orthodoxy followed Mendelssohn's path. They didn't sympathize with Kabbalah, they didn't believe in demons, they had a much more rational path. Secondly, you might say Mendelssohn's a good example because the German Orthodox themselves pointed to Mendelssohn. On the anniversary of Mendelssohn's death, the German Orthodox had a whole big commemoration for him. Hirsch, in his 19 letters, which we'll be speaking about a little later today, he cites Mendelssohn with esteem. He criticizes certain aspects, but his criticism of the Rambam is much stronger. And many German Orthodox Jews saw themselves following Mendelssohn. Yet I don't think we can see Mendelssohn as the founder of Neo-Orthodoxy. To begin with, he didn't create a movement. It was just him. His followers were not observant. He didn't start a movement. That's really the important point. Following Mendelssohn for a good 50 years, German observant Jews continued to live the way they had always lived, which meant basically living a ghetto life in Germany, refusing to participate in secular society. Secondly, I would say, Mendelssohn's ideology had the seeds of its own destruction in it. He entirely split Judaism and secular civilization. What Mendelssohn said is that there's no such thing as a separate Jewish philosophy. What's special to Jews is the law, revelation. But in terms of philosophy, the way we think, we're no different than the Gentiles outside of Torah. Only the law is revealed. Now, this type of thinking is foreign to modern Orthodoxy, all of whom believe that Judaism has a philosophy, and Hirsch specifically criticizes Mendelssohn on account of this. I just mentioned that the Jews of Germany refused to adapt, and therefore they would not be able to share in emancipation. They continued living in a ghetto type of life. Well, the Chatam Sofer, the great Rabbi Moses Sofer, rabbi in Pressburg, today Bratislava, he justified this. He made clear, and he is the most important figure, I believe, in Orthodoxy in the last 200 years, he made clear that emancipation was not in the Jews' best interests. Ghetto life, with all its hardships, was both a punishment for the Galut and the only way Jews could avoid assimilation. It was in the ghetto that Jews reached the height of creative power. Now, this idealization of pre-emancipation ghetto life was not just the Chatam Sofer's view. It was the standard view of the rabbinic elite, who wished to preserve Judaism as it was. Now, in the pages I sent out, and which you'll be able to get from Rabbi Kelman, I included two drashot of the Chatam Sofer. In one of them, he tells a mashal, a parable, about a man, a king, who sends his children out of his kingdom to go wander, telling them he's going to then call them back when the time is right. So they go out and they wander. And after a while, he sends his people out to build them nice houses in their wandering, telling them the time is not yet right to come back, but I'm going to build you a nice house. And these children, they're very upset. They have to thank their father because he does a nice thing for them. He's building them a house, but inside they're crying. And they were asked why they're crying. And they explained that as long as we were wandering and we knew we were coming back, that was okay. But now that our father is building us big palaces in the land of our wandering, we're assuming we're going to be here a lot longer. And therefore, although we have to thank him for what he does because he thinks he's doing us a favor, deep down we're very upset. And the Chatam Sofer then explains, it's the same thing with us. The diaspora, the Galut, is a punishment for us. Now that the nations are offering us emancipation, we have to thank them for this, publicly. But privately, we know that this is a bad thing. This means that we're going to be in the exile a lot longer. This is not what it's designed to be. We're supposed to be suffering. Because if we suffer in the exile, then we will be redeemed. Chatam Sofer also mentioned something interesting, that the closer we try to get to the non-Jews, by studying their language, the more they hate us. So we see in his writing, the two drasha, which I gave you, a complete rejection of the notion of emancipation, of joining together with them. This isn't just, he's not a reactionary figure in the sense we think of today. First of all, we can call him quietistic, which means he has a passive, withdrawn attitude to the world at large. We want to continue living the way we always have. When the Messiah comes, then we will live as first-class citizens. Until then, our role was to be second-class citizens, separate from the Gentiles. In addition, there is to be no involvement with secular studies, certainly not in an organized way. This is a type of assimilation that will lead us to involvement in secular culture, and will even lead to hatred of us. Now, by the way, I think that this notion that the more we try to act like the Gentiles, the more they hate us, while it might have been true at certain times in our history in Europe, it obviously isn't the case in America, where, on the contrary, the more we're like them, they want to marry us. But that is what the Chatam Sofer is saying. Furthermore, he's very worried about assimilation. And can anyone deny, when I said he's not this isn't just a simple reactionary position, look around at the world. Can there be any denying that assimilation and that rejection of Judaism has been a direct byproduct of the falling of the ghetto walls? When Jews were forced to dwell by themselves, you didn't have intermarriage, and everyone was observant. It was only when Jews were permitted to enter the outside world. So that is the Chatam Sofer's opinion, and it makes a lot of sense if you thinking in terms of the religious future of the Jewish people. Chatam Sofer was saying this at the same time that the Reform Movement arose in 19th century Germany. Now, most of you know the history of the Reform Movement. I'm not going to go through it, although understandably I will point out that it probably was inevitable. And although at the time, presumably, there was no other way to judge them but negatively from the Orthodox standpoint, in retrospect, I think we can actually see some positive aspects to it. Because remember, for many, Reform Judaism was actually a move to the right. Before Reform came on the scene, there was traditional Judaism and a secular type of Judaism, which quickly led to conversion. By simply converting, Jews in Germany opened up many avenues to them, the university, the civil service, high society. But these Jews who chose to be Reform, they were never going to be observant, Orthodox. And they didn't want to convert. Joining a Reform temple when they opened was actually a move to the right for many of them. And these Reform Jews actually suffered on account of their Judaism. It's hard to imagine today. But had they just taken this one further step and converted, many more things would have been open to them. But they had a certain type of Jewish pride. Obviously, it wasn't the traditional Jewish pride. And they refused to convert. And this led to them suffering in civil society. So I think we can judge them a little bit better than they have historically been judged. Now, why couldn't Orthodoxy, or it wasn't even called Orthodoxy, why couldn't traditional Judaism keep its young who were leading it in droves? Well, what was there in traditional Judaism in Germany? It was a backwards type of religion from their perspective. The young Jews were told that it was either traditional Judaism or nothing. There wasn't any notion of going to the university, of getting a profession. You had to live as a peddler or a merchant. There wasn't any chance to involve yourself in what was then the most advanced scientific and philosophically intellectual society in the world. You had to make a choice, either ghetto type of Judaism or rejection of Judaism. There was no middle ground then. And now this religion seemed something of the past, unimportant. If you wanted to advance intellectually, economically, culturally, you had to leave Orthodoxy. This pattern has repeated itself over and over again, incidentally. And the Orthodox lost its people. Last time this happened, I think, probably was the State of Israel in Palestine. There was only two types of Judaism. There was traditional Judaism and secular Zionism. There wasn't a form of modern Judaism. And therefore, a whole generation was lost. And it's repeated itself again and again. Even more important was the fact that the traditionalists could not fight back. They had nothing to offer the young people. You couldn't be a German patriot and be a traditional Jew. You couldn't be a secularly educated person. There were two alternatives. They could remain as they were, that is, traditional society, and be left with a small group, a core group of followers, And this was the approach of the Chatam Sofer, who coined the phrase, all that is new is forbidden from the Torah. Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. Any questions? I said that I paused, I didn't, but if anyone has questions, certainly, just send me a note on the bottom and I will reply to them. What does Chadash Asur Min HaTorah mean? It means that in the present era of reform and non-observance, we can't change anything. Everything has to remain the way it was. And if we're left with a small group of adherents, that's what we'll be left with. That will be the Torah true observant group. This is both a philosophic and a halachic stance. Even reforms, and we'll speak about reforms with Hirsch, with a small r, that were halachically permissible, were forbidden according to Chatam Sofer, because in our generation, if you permit anything, even if it's halachically permissible, that will open the floodgates to all sort of things. There's no room for dynamism, and it's opposed to the modern Orthodox stance, we'll soon see, that you adapt. As long as it's not halachically impermissible, you can adapt. Incidentally, I will tell you that, first, all the modern Orthodox thinkers will oppose the Chatam Sofer. He meant it as a form of public policy, only for his era. And whenever there was an issue, similar issues were confronted. It did not apply in traditional societies. It didn't apply in Sephardic societies. It applied in his era, and I will say that his own son, the Ketav Sofer, did not follow in his path. One of the things the Chatam Sofer said, and he repeated it, and he said it in his ethical will, which he gave on his death, was that you cannot hire a German preacher. Now, what could be, in Pressburg, what could be wrong with a German preacher? What's halachically wrong with preaching in the language that most people speak? After his death, his own son, the Ketav Sofer, realized that none of the young people could understand Yiddish. Therefore, we can either preach to no one, or we'll go against what my father wrote. And he chose to go against his father's view in this and in a number of other areas, and that created a huge dispute in Hungary. That was the creation of what we would call the Hungarian ultra-Orthodox, with Hillel Lichtenstein and others, who attacked the Ketav Sofer. They viewed him as a renegade, because although we think of him as a great sage, because he violated his own father's viewpoint. And they even basically put him in Chayram and the Pressburg Yeshiva. So it was a policy statement. But most people don't realize it's not just in the direction of more of extremism. It's not just in the direction of not having liberalization. It's the other way as well. Chadash Asur Min HaTorah means you don't make changes. That means all the new chumras we see arising on the scene today are impermissible according to the Chatam Sofer's view. Because if my father did it and my grandfather did it, that's the way we continue to do it. Once you make changes, then you open the doors to who knows what. I've seen this, for example. I have a sefer that is very opposed to this new practice of bringing Sifrei Torah to the computer. Every time they bring a Sefer Torah to the computer to check, they always find mistakes. So new, that seems like a good thing. And many Gedolim support it. But you have a group of Hungarians, led by Menashe Klein and others, who say, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. This is not the way we check Sifrei Torah. We check a Sefer Torah by a sofer, and if he misses something, we're not responsible for it. We're only responsible to do that which Moshe Rabbeinu did. Moshe Rabbeinu and the Chasam Sofer didn't have a computer, therefore we don't use computers. I saw in a Sefer another incredible thing. I mean, it strikes us as strange. Maybe in Geula, they follow this, but who follows this notion anymore? I often point out that I used to live near Eshet Torah in New York. Can you hear everything? Can other people hear? Raise your hand, Shalom.
I can hear fine.
Someone asked about the printing press for Sardim. I don't know if the printing press for Sardim, if there was a dispute about that. There was a dispute about machine matzahs, all sorts of disputes. Based on Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. The other thing I was just I mentioned Eshet Torah. Look what they do. Everything is Chadash today. I saw a very interesting example of this not too long ago in a Sefer. I forgot the name of it, in which he's very opposed to what everyone does. How do we know when Shabbos ends? We have these computer programs. We have a calendar that says Shabbos starts 5:35 and it's over 6:32, and they give you the exact time of Zman Kriya Shema to the second. And this Mechaber, this author, says this is all wrong. This is Chadash Asur. If you want to know when Shabbos starts, you do what the Gemara and the Rambam says. You go outside and you look at how the sun is over the horizon. If you want to know when you can read Kriyat Shema, you go outside and you see if you can tell the difference between blue and black. That's how we do things. All these newfangled inventions he's opposed to. But I think most believe that these are gifts, the modern world, just like we're doing right now. All the people arguing against Chodesh Hashanah and Torah, they use computers too. They would say it has to be in Torah, you know, you can't bring Chodesh into how we practice Judaism. But obviously most disagree. By the middle of the 19th century, however, there's another school of thought. It had arisen, and we call it modern orthodoxy or neo-orthodoxy. It's a response both to the Chatam Sofer, his extremism in opposing emancipation, in arguing that Jews should not be involved in secular culture on the one hand, so it's opposition to the right, and it's an opposition to the left, which argues that the left argued that in modern times there was simply reform or Chatam Sofer Judaism. And if you wanted to be involved in the modern world, you had to leave traditional Judaism, just like the Chatam Sofer says. Modern Orthodoxy would not accept this either-or. It would not accept Chodesh Asur Min HaTorah. Let's look at it then. The ideology of its leaders and what characterizes it. First of all, the first and most important of the figures is Samson Raphael Hirsch, born in the year 1808. He was fortunate that his enlightened parents gave him a secular education. From 1851, he would serve as rabbi in Frankfurt. He was first of the German rabbis to develop a philosophy which rejected the either-or approach. I'm going to give a little background in a minute. I just want to summarize. It was clear to him that traditional Judaism was failing in Germany. How to get the young generation attracted to Judaism. It was Hirsch who provided the ideology that helped stem the tide of defections and create a modern Orthodox identity, one which allowed the young and the old to remain halachically observant, even very stringent. Frankfurt developed a reputation as a very stringent extremist place in terms of observance, as well as enjoy modernity. He showed that the two were not in contradiction. He first burst on the scene as a young rabbi in the city of Oldenburg, in Germany. At the young age of 28, he published his 19 letters in Hebrew, Igrot Safun. For a long time, it was called Igrot Safon, Letters of the North. And there's a biography of Hirsch, not a very sympathetic biography, by Noah Rosenblum, who has about 15 pages in which he talks about what is the significance of this term, Igrot Safon. And he compares it to the Rambam, Igeret Teman, Letter of the South, writing to Yemen in the south, that area, and Hirsch in the north, writing Letter to the North. And he develops 10 or 15 pages, this whole idea. And I remember when I first read this, it was surprising to me because, as we'll see in a few minutes, the Rambam actually is very critical. Hirsch is very critical of the Rambam. The Rambam is his big opponent. His hero is Yehuda Levi and the Ramban. So that Hirsch would model himself after the Rambam struck me as very strange. And then I read Mordechai Breuer's review of Rosenblum's book. It's really a devastating review in many ways. But he points out that Breuer was unaware of a letter that Hirsch wrote in which he actually vocalized, punctuated this title. And it actually is Igrot Safun, Letters of the Hidden One, because he published it anonymously. So Rosenblum's whole theory about the Rambam styling himself as the 19th century Rambam falls apart because of one little dot. Instead of being on top of the letter, it's Safon, in the middle of the letter, it's Safun. It's a striking example of a theory that's totally demolished because of one dot. Before looking at Hirsch's ideas, let me say a few words about him, though. He grew up in Germany, as I said. He attended the university just for a couple of years. He never graduated, never finished. He did not have a PhD. He actually was friendly with Abraham Geiger at the university. It was at Bonn. And they studied Masachas Zevachim together. They were chavrusas. He then left the university. He studied with Rav Mordechai Banei, a great sage. He then became rabbi in Nikolsburg, Moravia, his third pulpit. His ideas were too radical for this community. We know they complained about him. He used to walk down the street with his wife, and they spoke about how when his predecessor, Mordechai Benet, the author of the Parashat Mordechai, a great halachic authority, when he walked down the street, the women would run so that they not appear in his path. We know that they complained that he taught them Chumash. He taught them Psalms. They joked that when Mordechai Benet was there, they recited Psalms and learned Gemara. But when Hirsch was there, they learned Psalms and recited Gemara. They did not regard him as a sufficient halachic authority, which he wasn't from the standpoint of the old sages. He was a new type of rabbi. Yes, the approach of the Chasam Sofer was a reaction to the exigencies of the era, no question about it. And the Sephardim, as Alan points out, is much closer to traditional Jewish behavior, no question about it. And the Chasam Sofer recognizes that. He's the first one to point out that if there's no reform in the world, other things could be done, more liberalizing approaches could be done, but with reform, that's why he says, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. If you want to know what traditional Judaism is, non-ideological, non-Orthodox Judaism, look at old-style Sephardic Judaism. You still see remnants of it in Israel, where even though people are not observant, the synagogue they go to when they go is the Orthodox synagogue. They have great respect for the Rabbanim. I was in an airport once, and someone was carrying a Sefer Torah through to a plane, and you see these Sephardic Jews, non-religious Jews, they see the Sefer Torah, they get up, they put a handkerchief on their head, they run over and kiss it. And the typical Ashkenazic Jews looking at it, three generations haven't been religious, they don't even know what a Sefer Torah is. I mean, that's the difference. When you go to the falafel stands in Israel and you see the pictures of the rabbis, it's a traditionalism that was very different. So that is correct. Both Chatam Sofer and Hirsch are responses to the modern era. But in modern times, you have to respond because you cannot continue living like you used to. Well, I don't agree that the response to contemporary culture is not new because, for the most part, Jews lived in the ghetto. Rashi never heard of Aquinas. Well, he couldn't have heard of Aquinas, came later. But Rashi never heard of parallel teachers. They didn't know Latin. He knows some French for the streets, but Rashbam knew something about non-Christian thinkers. But the average Jew, before emancipation, lived in a ghetto. They did not have to confront modernity. In Italy, you did. In Italy, you have a different form of modern Orthodoxy. But for the most part, Jews, certainly in Eastern Europe, do you know that most Jews in Poland did not even speak Polish? There were Jews, or Russian for that matter. You see a reflection of that in The Fiddler on the Roof, where you have that one intellectual who can read the newspaper. They were not a part of secular society or culture. They didn't go to the university. So they were very separate, and you cannot speak of response to contemporary culture in 15th century Germany or 18th century Krakow. Getting back to Hirsch, he was not regarded as an outstanding Talmudist of the old style. Certainly he was a great sage. Just look at his Perush on Vayikra, and you see what a great sage he is in arcane matters of sacrifices. But he is not of the old school, no question about it. He also instituted reforms, holding a wedding in the synagogue, which today is pretty common, although I don't know about Toronto, but certainly in most parts of the world, we now have weddings in the synagogue. That was a reform. He dressed in clerical garb. He used a choir. This might have been fine in Germany, but not in Moravia, Central Europe. While in Oldenburg, he actually abolished Kol Nidre. He created a bit of a storm, and he stopped that for after a year or two. These were reforms with a small r. There is no question that, was it not for the reform movement, Hirsch would have instituted other reforms as a means of bringing Judaism up to date and bringing the young people closer. In fact, we'll see soon that his strong opposition to the reform movement was, I think, in large measure driven by the desire to show that his reforms are reforms with a small r, that he had nothing to do with the big reforms. He got into great difficulty in Moravia, and this combined with his desire to create a new type of Judaism led him to come to 1851 to Frankfurt, where he became rabbi of a small breakaway community. What does that mean, breakaway community? In Germany, all Jews were required by law to belong to a community, one community. And you pay taxes to the community, and the tax money would then be used to support the hospital, the old age home, pay the rabbi's salaries. Fine, not a problem. What to do, though, when there are Reform synagogues in town? You pay taxes, and these tax money goes to the Reform synagogues. Many observant Jews had a real problem with that. They created a breakaway synagogue. They continue to pay taxes, but they wanted their own rabbi, Hirsch. And he comes to Frankfurt, and he actually leads the whole movement so that the law is changed, and we'll talk about this next class, and that Jews no longer need to pay taxes to the one community, and that creates a huge dispute in German Orthodoxy. And I'll just anticipate what I'm going to say. There you see already one of the big differences. Hirsch was a separatist. He wanted nothing to do with the Reform movement, as we'll talk about. And yet when we think about modern Orthodox Jews today, we think about those Jews who believe in cooperating with Reform. Ironically, it was the great old-style rabbinic figure in Germany, Rabbi Bamberger, the great Talmudist who had no problem being in one community. So you see, here's the first example of how Hirsch, who we're calling modern Orthodox, diverges in a very significant way by the typical modern Orthodox person today. So he comes to Frankfurt. Now earlier, to go back a minute, I mentioned Igrot Safon, the 19 letters. This is one of the most significant works of the 19th century Jewish intellectual history. It elaborates a new conception of Judaism. Now, I think if you read it today, you'll say, what's the big deal? It seems to be full of cliches. But understand that when Hirsch wrote it, it was not. And the reason why we see that it's cliched is because it was so successful. When he published the book, it was novel and controversial. Gretz, the great Jewish historian, Heinrich Gretz, writes how when he read it, it so attracted him that he left where he was, he went to Hirsch, and he lived with Hirsch in Oldenburg for 3 years in his house and became his student. Later, Gretz and Hirsch would have a great break over Hirsch's opposition to the critical study of Judaism. We'll talk about that as well, because another difference between the YU, say, approach to Judaism, modern Orthodoxy, and Hirsch. Geiger thought that this work was significant enough to write a refutation of, a review of it. Now, with one exception, everything of significance that Hirsch would ever write about or speak about is found in the 19 letters. The one exception is what I just mentioned, his view of separatism, that is, complete separatism from the non-Orthodox. So this is the first statement of modern Orthodoxy. There's a book called Orthodoxy, some of you might be aware of, not by a Jewish author, by a Christian author, a great author, not always so sympathetic to Jews, but a great author nonetheless, G.K. Chesterton. And if you read this book and you substitute Judaism for Christianity, it really is very enlightening. He wrote about Orthodoxy. He's writing about Christian Orthodoxy. But he writes that Orthodoxy need not stand for a dull and stubborn reactionary approach to things, but on the contrary, it could be, quote, the natural foundation for revolution and reform. That is, and he writes about how Orthodoxy, I quote this in my book on Weinberg, is actually the most exciting form of Judaism. I mean, it's like you're being pulled by fast horses going one side to the other, because Orthodoxy is about being involved in serious thing on a day-to-day basis. Coming to synagogue a few times a year because to perform some rituals, that's not what it means to be involved in something. And he elaborates, and it's really, someone should do, someone once commented to me after I mentioned Chesterton, that it would be a great thing if someone plagiarized him and wrote a Jewish Chesterton, because it would be very influential. In any event, Chesterton also, well, before he get more, he could have been speaking of Hirsch. Remember what I said. Orthodoxy is, quote, the natural foundation of revolution and reform, because many of Hirsch's ideas were very novel. Chesterton also wrote that if you want to reform, be orthodox. That is, real reform is only found in orthodoxy, because if you're not orthodox and you reform, you've changed the religion. It becomes something new. But if you're orthodox, if you're really committed, then you can have reforms, not in the basis, not in the basic principles, but in the secondary principles. And that they become part of the religion. because your moorings are so strong that you can then reform, and it's okay. Not to mention the practical side that Hirsch well recognized, that if you reform and you're not in the Orthodox group, no one's going to take it seriously. If the conservatives come up with a new idea, bat mitzvah, prenuptial agreement, whatever they come up with, we can't adopt it because they're not in the group, and we don't think they're authentic in their reasons for suggesting the reform, even if they don't appear to have any halakhic problems. In order for a reform to be accepted, it must be advocated by the members of our own community. And that's a truism. So in order to reform, in order to be Orthodox, reform. But if you want to, in order to reform, be Orthodox. And Hirsch also turns it on its head. Not just in order to reform, be Orthodox, in order to be Orthodox, reform. Because Hirsch said that for Orthodoxy to survive in modern times, it must reform. Let's talk about that reform. Reform in ideas as well as action. And we've seen some of them, but we'll talk more. First of all, in ideas, in ideology. Hirsch termed his ideology Torah im derech eretz, Torah and the way of the world. The phrase comes from Pirkei Avos. It means perhaps Torah and having a livelihood, but for Hirsch it means something very different. It means Torah and civilization, being involved in secular civilization. To the extent it doesn't consider Torah. I once gave a whole talk about Hirsch, and I kept using this expression without explaining it. And I wrote about how the yeshiva world rejected his idea of Torah im derech eretz, and a woman came up to me afterwards and started literally screaming at me, how dare I say that they don't accept Torah im derech eretz in the yeshiva? And the rabbi was there with me, and we couldn't understand what she was talking about. Her son is in the Haredi yeshiva, and it didn't make sense. And after a few minutes, it became apparent she understood derech eretz, meaning good manners. So throughout the lecture, when I was talking about how the Haredi world did not accept Torah im derech eretz, she thought I was saying that the Haredim don't believe in having good manners and that they're rude, and that's not what it means. The notion of Torah im derech eretz is based on the idea that the ghetto is an unnatural environment. Jews were put in the ghetto against our will by non-Jewish rulers. In the ghetto, Jews are not living true Judaism. They're living a Judaism cut off from civilization. That's not what we want. We're supposed to be involved. The greatest Kiddush Hashem is the Jewish doctor, the Jewish lawyer, the Jewish civil servant, the Jew who's the public intellectual and who brings Jewish ideas out to the wider world. And I know that in Toronto, Torah in Motion has many examples of this, bringing Jewish insights to bear on matrimonial assets. I read Rabbi Selman's column on other things. That's what it means for Hirsch. And he looked to the Golden Age of Spain and said, that's what it means to be a Jew. The Gentiles put us out of where we should be. But that's not where we should be. We should be together with the wider world, bringing our insights to bear on civilization. That's how we really fulfill the Torah. We are meant to be patriotic. We're meant to be part of greater civilization. No Jew in Poland was patriotic. They didn't think that patriots are anti-Semitic Poland. They had nothing to do with the country. We want to fit in with enlightened society, enlightened German society, in any way it's halakhically permissible. So, for example, in enlightened German society, people regarded as proper, enlightened, advanced, that the clergy wear gowns. That's respect. Is there any halakhic problem with wearing a gown? What could be the problem? Therefore, rabbis in Germany wear gowns. So when people come to the synagogue, they treat it with respect. Choirs. Sermons. Sermons that speak about edification and enlightenment. These are all things that German Jews came to expect, just like in Gentile society, so too German society. Decorum. Cutting the beard when necessary. Is there an obligation to walk around with a full beard? If that's going to make people think that Judaism is some sort of savage religion, that the general society regards being clean-shaven or having a small beard as the way to live, therefore Jews have to look that way. Otherwise, people will not take Judaism seriously. And for Hirsch, this was all proper because these were not the ikar. These were the tuffel. These were the appurtenances. These were the outside things which change in every society. Our dress is different in every society. The way we cut our hair is different in every society. We have to deal with the people among whom we live. We have to show that Judaism is an advanced civilization as well. Taking off the kippah. Okay, 5 more minutes, I'm told. Taking off the kippah. By the way, the classes will go. Wherever we stop, and we'll pick up. They will not necessarily close. Taking off the kippah when not at worship. That was a practice in Germany. In Hirsch's own school, you did not wear a kippah for the secular subjects. Now you're going to say, why not? Because in Germany, that was not thought to be proper. There's nothing halakhically wrong with it, he thought, and therefore, for secular subjects, you don't do it. I'm sure Hirsch would have preferred that everyone wear it, but in the society they were in, that's not what you did, so you work with the society you're in. You educate women. Hirsch created a school to educate boys and girls. The fact that girls are not educated, well, maybe that works in Poland. In the ghetto, it doesn't work in modern times. And as I said, the greatest Kiddush Hashem is someone who can live in the modern world. The glory of Japhet in the tents of shame, what we recently read in the Torah. He sees religious value in German authors, in particular Schiller. One of the most important ideas in the Jewish religious personality, according to him, is that you can achieve religious growth by reading non-Jewish works. He's different than Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn thought that when you read a secular writing, you're reading a secular work, you're no different than a non-Jew. Hirsch thought that every time you read a secular work, you bring your Judaism to bear. You view it through the prism of Torah. Secular works have to be viewed through this prism. German literature is valuable because it reflects Torah values. We can learn about how to be a religious personality, a good personality from these, and it affects our religion. Everything is evaluated through Judaism. Schiller was truth, and Hirsch's truth has one origin. Hirsch could not have been more opposed to the view that all truth is in the Torah. He pointed to passages in the Talmud that showed that the Talmudic sages learned from non-Jews. So too, Jews must learn from Schiller. And if you know anything about German Orthodoxy, you know that Bar Mitzvah boys were not given Sfarim. They were given works from Schiller and other things. It's ironic that now there is a collection of Hirsch's writings. 6 or 7 volumes translated to English. One thing they don't translate is the essay on Schiller. Because today that doesn't fit that you'd write this way. But this is very important to Hirsch. At the anniversary of Schiller's death, they had a special school assembly, and he spoke about this. According to Mordechai Breuer, it's not a synthesis that Hirsch is interested in, although some disagree, but rather you have secular civilization and you have Torah civilization, and they meet, and they fructify one another. But it's not that secular civilization is Torah. It has Torah insights. Hirsch even wrote that he could see no danger for school children being exposed to Christian ideas, since they will recognize that the good things in Christianity comes from Judaism, and that you can even look at the description of a Christmas evening and enjoy this because Jews will understand that this is really all from Judaism, this notion of family. Well, you're saying it sounds a lot like Soloveitchik. Certainly, every modern Orthodox thinker, modern Orthodoxy is unimaginable without Hirsch. But there are differences. We've already seen the Reform. We're going to see the Zionist in difference as well. Why don't we stop here? I'll pick up next class about other aspects where Hirsch changed. I'll take some questions. I will talk next class about why Hirsch was so opposed to Wissenschaft, why Hirsch was very opposed to the academic study of Judaism. I see it's on my notes in about 2 pages. We will see a huge dispute in German Orthodoxy between Hirsch and Hildesheimer, between Frankfurt and Berlin. So that'll be the third big difference where Hirsch breaks with modern Orthodoxy. So he provides the basis, but he breaks. No, well, the Chasam Sofer never attacked Hirsch. Hirsch wasn't really on the scene, the Chasam Sofer. The Chasam Sofer's students, some of them attacked German Orthodoxy, others did not. For the most part, they said, it's okay in Germany. Don't try to bring it into Poland. Don't try to bring it into Hungary. We'll talk about this on the next session. In my book on Rabbi Weinberg, I speak about that. The Eastern Europe and Central Europe, they said, leave German Orthodoxy. They said it's a para aduma, a red heifer. If you bring German Orthodoxy to the East, it'll make all the people in the East non-religious. And yet it helps to make people in Germany religious. What's the problem? Because German Orthodoxy, as we'll see next class, is not about Talmud study as the be-all and end-all. You couldn't bring a modern rabbi to the East. So let's look forward to the next session. I enjoyed this very much. Please, if anyone has questions, certainly email me at my university address. If there are things I left out, it wasn't clear, I will be on 10 of next class. We can talk about a few things. I'll stay on, by the way, whoever wants to stay on with me. And if you have technical problems, show him in the right corner there. I'm sure he can help out. But so we'll end it now. But I'll stay on for a few minutes if anyone has any questions.
Thank Mark,
you.
I have a question.
Thank you very much.
Mark, this is Dov. I have a question.
Okay.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
So it sounds like you're saying that that Hirsch's ideas could not have been developed before his time because the circumstances were not the same.
Well, they could have been developed when there was an emancipation. Before emancipation, they certainly could have been developed because the whole point was Jews are now in modern Germany. They're in the modern society, and they have to live there. So,
exactly, yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah. Yes, correct. And they never did. Any other comments or questions? Okay, well, then I will...
Yes, one question?
Yeah.
In Germany at that time, what percentage of the Jews were Shomer Mitzvahs, I guess I'd put it?
It's hard to get a handle on it. If you're talking, let's say, 1850, in the villages, we still have a majority. I would say it's like 80-90% in this. And there were Jews who lived rural lifestyles. There were Jewish farmers in Germany. People don't realize this. See, there's a whole book called Jewish Rural Communities in Germany. But in the big cities, you're talking by 1850, majority non-religious. And by the turn of the century, the figure, we think 20% in the entire country. So I would say 1850, the big cities, majority non-religious, figure 20%, 30%. Certainly in the villages, overwhelming religiosity. And that begins to change because with the Reform rabbis getting pulpits in the small villages, one synagogue, one rabbi, things begin to change very quickly in the 1860s, the 1850s, and 1860s. So in Frankfurt, when Hirsch came in 1851, the Reform had taken over the city. They had shut down the mikvah. They were running the show in Frankfurt, Ir Vaim B'Yisrael, and the Orthodox were a minority in Frankfurt by 1850, as well as Berlin.
Okay, I want to thank everybody, and we are most interested in hearing anybody's comments. We're constantly working on improving our technology, but I want to thank, you know, Mark and Shalom and everybody, and we hope to see you, and you can let all your friends know, and we're interested in terms this can really be powerful all over the world. So any ideas you have, please let us know.
One question, Jay.
Yes.
Can people listen to this? After
yes, okay. Yes, so we just opened up our MP3 library in general, like last week, but we are recording it. David, I think, can go and confirm that. He can, if he wants to write that or speak up. We're even looking into making a video of this available. So, you know, we're still early in our technological experiment here, but yes, the idea is people can actually download. People have asked if they have to miss a class, can they hear it later? Absolutely. You know, the idea, of course, of this program is that people come and participate, ask questions, to make it more interactive. But obviously, people can hear the recording later on.
Okay. Goodbye, everyone.
Okay. What I recommend to the people. If you want to send us the email, you know, to info@torahinmotion.org, and we'll put you in contact with Mark. I'm glad Scott, your wife, could go out shopping, I'll hopefully send an email with Mark's address.
And one more thing, Jay, what about those pages? If anyone wants to see them.
Yeah, so we'll have to get them to people. We'll try to scan them into our website. I guess somehow. The other stuff you sent me, we did post, the images.
I sent you everything. I sent you all the pages.
Believe
I sent
it's,
you
Right. So I believe it's on our website. I'm going to check with our web guys.
Okay.
A link was already sent.
Jay, Mark, and Mark Scott is saying that he received an email with those texts.
Okay. Please send me another. Please send me that link, and I'll just check to make sure all is good. Okay.
Okay. You know, for the people who registered just in the last day, which is more than half the people, so I don't think they would have gotten Scott. You probably registered earlier, I'm guessing.
Okay. I'm going to go now. Send me a link, please, and I look forward to seeing everyone next week.